This is an ABC podcast.
I'm Lisa Leong. Welcome to This Working Life. Now imagine you're going to build a whole new workforce. Let's do it from scratch. So we're talking no company laws, no rules and regulations, but we're going to add in some more design constraints. We're going to make the first team only 4 people. We're going to make the workspace quite cramped, shall we say, and the commute takes 7 months. Yes, we're talking about building a new workforce on Mars. And with me is astronaut candidate Diane McGrath. Hello.
G'day, Lisa. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Mars One is an ambitious project to get Earth people to Mars, shall we put it that way? And it is a one-way ticket.
Yes, it is one way.
So we will deal with that in just a moment. But first, I'd really like to talk about things from a career point of view. Because in This Working Life, we obsess about career choices. And I must say that yours is quite unique.
It is indeed. When people ask me what I do for a living, I kind of say random stuff. Because if you say, oh, I might be going to Mars, it kind of derails conversation a little bit. So I tend to talk about other aspects of life first. And then when the conversation, when it naturally bubbles up in conversation, then I say, oh, I could be going to Mars.
Because what's the reaction to that when you say that?
Curious. People are quite curious until I say the one-way bit. And then when I say the one-way bit, it's like someone's jammed the brakes on straight away. It's like, whoa, back it up there a bit. What? Why can't you return? Why would you do that? What would you miss? What about your family? What about chocolate? All of these really critically important life things.
So I think what we need to do is let's hit the top questions that you get asked. One-way ticket, are you mad? What are you talking about?
The selection criteria ensured that we would be of sound mind and body. So I am of sound mind, apparently. And the element about why one way, for me, that's part of the attraction, not because I want to leave this beautiful planet, but the opposite. I want to do something towards this beautiful planet to show that we can live sustainably as a society. People don't want to change their behaviour. Look at any workforce. How difficult is change? Whether it's large scale or small scale, like cultural change is even harder. Imagine if we tried to truly, truly act on changing our environment to prevent what is going to be catastrophic climate change. Most people don't want to give up their comfort zone, do they? So I thought, well, if we can show that we can do that on Mars, where resupply is impossible, we have to be generating all of our own electricity, growing all of our own food, can't have any waste, all this sort of stuff. If we can do that for Mars in a tiny closed loop, then surely we can do it for this planet.
Because that's what I was intimating when I introduced the concept, which is when we try and design new workspaces and a workforce, we will still always have that legacy. So what you're saying is we could design a whole new world from scratch. And in fact, the constraints will help us be very mindful about things like sustainability, which is one of your key interests.
Absolutely. And I think that the more constraints we place on ourselves sometimes in organisations, the more creative we become. I know when I used to work in marketing for a number of years in the pharmaceutical industry, whenever there was budget cuts, like major budget cuts, which happens all the time, or something else dramatic happened in the market, you had to deal with it. You had to respond, and usually it was you found creative solutions to these problems. So constraints can actually force better creative solutions.
One of the key facts in this tale is that you were born the day before the Apollo 11 landing on the moon. Is that right?
That is correct. Both the lunar landing and I celebrate our 50th anniversary this year. Pretty cool. Yeah, I was born the day before, so I don't remember a great deal of it, I must admit. I don't know whether my mother held me up in front of a television in the hospital or not, but anyone who was alive at that time would know exactly where they were. and it united all of humanity. We felt at that time we could do something truly extraordinary.
How old were you when you saw
it? It was only for Mars One. It was back in 2013, so it was April 2013. I saw this ad in a science blog that had a headline of something along the lines of astronauts wanted for one-way trip to Mars. I thought, oh, is this for real? And then my friend had heard of it. She said, yeah, and she told me all about what their goal was and who they were and so on. And so I deep dived into it for quite a few months to work out who they were because I was so fascinated. How could we do this? What, we're going to Mars? How can humans survive on Mars? Because what I understood about the planet, you can't breathe there. There's, you know, there's no atmosphere really, and the radiation will kill you. There's no running water. How can we do this? So I was so excited.
Were you already working in sustainability?
I had been working for the government at that stage for a number of years. I had been in energy policy, and in fact, I had previously done some work with renewable energies, energy, and then I worked on the national consumer laws for energy, and I'd also worked on the white paper for our energy future. So I had a pretty good understanding about Australia's challenges and opportunities with energy, and I thought, you know, here's another thing. And I at the time, I'd already started doing some part-time study at uni as well, doing some postgraduate study in sustainability, and thought, well, I'm hooked. This is really interesting to me. Then I went and researched the company and researched more about Mars. I spent a lot of time having a look at what the health risks were for astronauts and considering what would I be trading off or giving up if I decided to go to Mars one way, what would the joy of spending time with loved ones, all that sort of stuff. Like, how do I trade that sort of stuff off? What's important? So that was, once I felt comfortable that I'd done a pros and cons kind of list and I knew that the company was legitimate and it looked like a good model, I pressed send.
You mentioned looking into the health risks. Mm. What are they?
They're pretty extreme. I mean, in space, that 7-month journey from Earth to Mars, when you're weightless, we're not getting that bone signaling and muscle mass deteriorates as well. So you lose bone mass, you lose muscle mass. Astronauts that come back from the space station have vision impairment or hearing impairment. One of the other things that happens is we get challenged by our immune system quite a bit more too. So sleeplessness, people get about an hour's less sleep in space than they do on Earth. And so many different aspects, nutrition as well, astronauts notoriously undereat, and so that also impacts on health.
When I think of an astronaut, I do think of someone who is superhuman. One of the things I absolutely love about the way in which the workforce, the four of you who would go in the first capsule to Mars, is that there was a surprising selection criteria. Which, when I first heard it, made me cry. Can you share them, please?
Yeah, it's the selection criteria is focused around human qualities and not necessarily technical skill or existing technical skill. Absolutely, people have to be intelligent because we'll have to learn everything from IT coding to the how to fix the plumbing. You know, so we'll trained on that sort of stuff over 10 plus years. But when we think about it, this is about developing a new community together. So like you said earlier, Lisa, when we're looking at developing a new organisation, the culture matters. And what are the things that contribute to that? It's the people. And so if we can think about the right sort of qualities that people have, how adaptable are they? How resilient are they? Are they curious? Do they trust themselves and each other? And what about their creative and resourcefulness in challenging situations? So those are the five main criteria: resourcefulness, adaptability, trust, curiosity, and I guess that that element of resilience as well. I mean, things go wrong. It's not a case of if something goes wrong and on Mars, it will. There's absolutely no doubt. And in everyone's organisations.
But things go wrong in life. So absolutely. I love the fact that these qualities, as you say, these human qualities are so essential. And it's been decided that these are the qualities that we actually need for this Mars One project.
Yes, right. And they need to be underpinned by the capacity for self-reflection. I've heard the head of selection discuss this in the past, and when I thought about that, that makes sense. If we don't have the understanding of our own strengths or weaknesses, then how can we make the best of any situation or be able to draw on those of our teammates?
Should we test adaptability? What question did they ask?
I can't remember the exact wording for this one in the application process, but it was around when things didn't go right. Tell us about a time when something didn't go right and how did you deal with it?
And did you have a specific story for that one?
I'm pretty sure I would have spoken about when I used to work in the pharmaceutical industry, because I worked in marketing in pharmaceuticals for quite some time. And I remember at one stage I was working on a joint venture with another company, and the product that we were looking after was failing miserably. Like we were $5 million below budget. Oh. Like we had lost essentially $5 million. And I remember going home at night and pretty much crying, having peanuts and a drink of gin. I don't really drink these days, but I think I've cured from that. But I remember that just really tearing me down and thinking, what do I do? You know, I need to change things both for me and for the sales team of 120 people that were working under me and the other marketing managers to deliver on this failing concept. And so essentially I just looked at what was working and what wasn't working and then started to realize that everybody's got answers already in some other different ways. And how about if we open up the doors, if we become curious and seek to understand what some of the sales team out there are doing that are the tiny wins? It's so easy to focus on, oh, you're not going to hit 5 million. But everyone out there, the 120 reps, all had their own small targets that they were trying to hit every single day. And sometimes they were successful. So I changed the way I started operating. And I cleared out my calendar on a Friday and I would ring the reps around the country and start talking to them and record information about their small successes and then start sharing those with the rest of the company. So they became the hero, even in a failing situation. And the morale in the company was just lifted through what was really quite a simple act.
And what then happened?
We didn't manage to, you know, make up $5 million, but we definitely made up the morale. We retained staff at a time when it was looked like it would be a sinking ship. And that's, I think, an important message for people in any sort of business. Sometimes you're not always going to achieve what your goals are, and that's okay. Sometimes you can rejig the goals, but you can't always do that when it's a, you know, sales target and you're partway through the financial year or whatever. That's life. So what can you salvage from it? What can you achieve out of it? Perhaps you can learn something that will help you in the next financial year, and perhaps you can do something that ensures that your staff are appreciated and are valued, because they're the ones that drive success all the time.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the details. So there were 200,000 applicants who applied after seeing this ad. Then it was shortlisted down to 100?
1,058 first, and then after that they chose 1,058 of us to go through medical tests, which were pretty extensive, the same sort that pilots will often take and NASA will request their astronaut candidates to go through as well. And a number of people that didn't pass that were actually younger, not more senior like myself.
Because you're 49, because you've already dropped that you're turning 50.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. And how old were you at the time?
So I was in my mid-40s, mid to...
Right.
Yeah, so I was exceptionally healthy.
There's no age limit,
No,
is there?
That's correct. No age limit. There's a health limit. And that's one of the things a few of us more senior candidates have asked the selection committee head and the chief medical officer, Dr. Kraft, whether there will be an age limit. There is a bottom... like a floor, people had to be at least 18 to sign up.
Right.
But there's no upper age limit at all.
Why is that?
Well, the number doesn't really matter. It's really more health about our health status. And the oldest person who's been to space has been 77. So me, if I'm lucky enough to get to go, especially in the early crews, I'll be in my early 60s. So there's at least a decade or more of probably healthy capacity to commit to getting this community off the ground.
What are the benefits of having an older person?
With the radiation exposure, the health risks come with accumulation.
Uh-huh.
So if we have a shorter lifespan left for us when we go to Mars, we can almost afford to spend a lot more time out on the planet exposed to more radiation. Whereas a younger person on Mars in the early days will be a lot more limited with how much time they can spend out on the planet. They'll have to limit it to an hour or less a day, which means that their capacity to be able to contribute to some of the external construction work will be quite limited.
So you get to the interview stage, there's 100 left, then what happens?
Then the next stage of selection. So what's coming up for us, most likely to be next year, will be where they trim the 100 of us who are left down to eventually 12 to 24 candidates to start the 10 plus years of training. What they're really looking for in this next stage of selection is about fit and culture. Do we know how to play nicely with other people? So they're bringing all 100 of us together to a desert location. We don't know where. We suspect it could be Jordan. But in advance of being brought together, Mars One have asked us to self-organise into 10 diverse crews of 10.
Oh, right.
So diverse in gender. So there'll be 5 men and 5 women in each crew, diverse in age and diverse in culture. Over what will be up to 5 days of selection, the crews will be competing against each other in technical and team dynamic sort of events. And at the end of each day of the selection process, the selection committee will kick out 10 to 20 people a day. Then we reorganise into new diverse teams the next day.
Oh, wow. So it's very hard to create a team feeling if you know that the people that made you successful in the first round, they're going to break you up.
Correct.
Because that's actually happened to me before in an experiment, and I found it extremely disconcerting and sad, and I nearly didn't get over it.
And it's an interesting concept. Why is this important, and why does Mars One want to do this? If you think about it, it's about the success of that team for that particular endeavour. So it shouldn't matter who's a part of that. It's about the vision. So if we think about our organisations and the workforce, we're often put into different teams sometimes to achieve something. We might be having to work across different departments within a large organisation or with external suppliers or whatever it is. And it's for the purpose of achieving a particular outcome. If we focus on the outcome and how we as a group can do it, it shouldn't matter who's in the group. It really shouldn't matter. What should matter is you all have the same shared vision about achieving that outcome. And there's going to be conflict, and that's what they're trying to force, some conflict, because they want to see how do we deal with that. And conflict can be as simple as perhaps you've got a different idea for achieving that outcome than me, and both of them are great ideas. How do you resolve that? Because that's often, I mean, you think about brainstorming, when something goes wrong in our organisations, when we're trying to deal with a new hurdle that we hadn't expected, everyone gets brought together, right? You sit down in your team and go, right, how on earth are we going to solve this? And lots of people throw in ideas, unless, of course, they get knocked out. You don't have these people in teams that sometimes just go, nah, 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 that's not helpful. Instead, the idea should be, there's a gem of an idea in that. What is it about that idea that might help us find a solution? And if we can find ways to open that, to be curious about the idea, about how it might solve the problem, then that shows that you're prepared to work as a team. It's not about you. It's about the team and that outcome. No matter who's in the team, no matter what their gender is, their age, their culture, no matter what team they've come from, shouldn't matter.
I'm interested in this pressure situation that you'll be in, and what type of mental and emotional work you will be doing to kind of get rid of the ego in this, which might come up as you know that you may get knocked out at any point.
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the things that I work on constantly myself in preparation for this. Like, how can I be the best me that I can be for this event, this organisation? Because I know that my success is only going to come in the success of any crew that I'm with on day one or two or whatever day I manage to continue through to. So I've had to try and let go of the ego aspect. I do a lot of meditation, a lot of journaling, work out the things in my life that maybe my triggers for hanging on to that identity. Who am I? And what are the labels and roles that I take? And that's one of the challenges. In a workforce, that aspect of role, how can we work more effectively in teams by recognising that we'll often adopt particular roles or be forced in particular roles? How flexible are we around that? And can we allow ourselves to play around and try some different roles in a safe environment, sometimes on smaller scale projects at work, that allow us to learn to be more flexible around that, and we can let go of some of the ego that we often get attached to when it's like, oh, I'm the this person. I'm the creative person. I'm the organised one who always takes the minutes. Let someone else take the minutes today.
But we also want to know what's unique about ourselves. Mm. So what's the difference between I know my unique superpower and that's ego in the way?
Yeah, it's an interesting balance, isn't it? And it's not that we shouldn't be aware of ourselves. I think awareness, self-awareness is critical. And I know Mars One, as I mentioned earlier, the ability to self-reflect and know yourself underpins the capacity to draw on those five qualities of resilience, adaptability, and so on. So if I know what I'm good at, that's fantastic. But is that particular skill going to be the critical one for the success of that organisation or that particular instance? I think in particular of a case when you might recall the Chilean mining disaster. Remember when the miners got trapped kilometres pretty much just about, was it kilometres? Yeah, it was actually, underground.
Yeah.
And they were stuck under there for weeks, absolute weeks. Everyone thought they were going to die. They thought they were going to die. The gentleman who was the foreman of that crew was down there too. And very shortly after they realised, we're stuck down here, we don't know if we're going to get out, he symbolically took off his foreman hat, not literally but symbolically, and said, well, I'm no longer the foreman here. We're all in this together. We need to work out how we're going to survive, who has what it takes for these different things. Someone had a great passion, for example, for religion and decided to run small group sessions for those who wished to that were around prayer and relaxation and meditation and gratitude and so forth. Other people had great food skills, and so the rations they had, how do we make them last? And so they realised that leadership is situational. It's not necessarily something which is owned by somebody. And so I think being aware of yourself and knowing, yeah, I'm a great foreman, but that's not necessarily what's needed at that time.
Oh, I love that. That made me cry. That's beautiful. Now, where are we?
We're still on Earth.
Right. We're still on Earth. What happened in the moment when you told your parents about this?
I didn't actually tell them straight away. I didn't tell.
Oh, hang on. Have you not told them yet?
I have. Mum, are you listening to this? I've got something to tell you. I'm not pregnant. However, there's something else which is for life and it's not just a child. I didn't tell anybody except for my best mate and my partner at the time that I was applying, because when I saw how many people had applied or were in the process of applying, because you had to make your application publicly known, oh, there's no way they're not going to choose me, because I saw some of the candidates and they were people that worked for NASA at the time and astrophysicists and super, super smart people that had, I guess, existing skills in that sort of area. I knew the qualities they were looking for were the human qualities, but I didn't know how much that really was weighing against the skills you had, but clearly it was, you know, important. Eventually I told her, like, you know, I've applied for this job that, you know, I could go to Mars. And she was incredibly excited.
Hang on, did you tell her Mars and it's one way?
Well, I dropped the one way clanger a little later, not the first thing in the conversation. It was that easy, easy, and then get her excited about the idea and then go, yeah, not coming back. Yeah.
Response from her?
Bit of silence to start with. But then my mum's attitude in life is, why not?
If you go on this mission and you decide to not come back to Earth, what are the three things you'll miss about Earth?
Other than dairy, because you can imagine they're not going to put a cow in a spaceship, are they? The most dramatic thing that I'll probably miss about Earth will be the natural environment. We won't be able to feel the sun on our skin ever again after we leave this planet. We'll always be in a space suit when we're out on the planet of Mars. So never again the wind in our hair or sun on our skin. And how much of that do we take for granted?
Thanks, Diane.
Thanks, Lisa.
And this weekend marks the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 11 moon landing. And of course, a very happy 50th to Di. Now, while some in the scientific community are sceptical as to whether this mission to Mars will ever get off the ground, I think that there's much we can learn from Di's experience, especially about the way we can all work as a team. We'll get Diane back when she comes back from overseas to talk biohacks to optimise work performance, a passion we both share. You can hear my previous flirtations with performance-enhancing biohacks, along with a healthy dose of scepticism, on our podcast. Just search This Working Life in your podcast app. And while you're there, hit up those stars. Rating and reviewing helps others find our podcast. Help spread the word. And we love hearing from you. email us directly on thisworkinglife@abc.net.au. This Working Life is produced by Maria Tickle. I'm Lisa Leong. Until next week, keep working.
This is Ground Control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade. And the papers want to know who's
judging where. Can we do another 5 hours? Anyone got time? Time? Sorry.
When I'm back, we can do as much as you like. I'm back in a few months.
That's right.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.